Blog Talk Radio.
You're just flying nowhere, spending someone's heart.
Hey there, everybody. It's rebooting the news again for another week with me and my buddy Jay over there. Jay, how's it going?
Hi, Dave. Good
that was a little snippet of the Beatles because, of course, you know, we've been playing music lately. And
yeah. This
is would be the 70th birthday, roughly, of John Lennon. And so I thought, let's play a little bit of John Lennon. And they're more harmonious, two of us times, because it's one of the very few songs in that period where the Lennon and McCartney both sang.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we have
a guest
here.
That's yeah.
Would you like to introduce him?
Today is Saul Hansel, who is the head of Seed.com, a division of AOL, and for many years was a technology reporter at the New York Times. Somebody Dave and I both know, and somebody very involved in the rebooting the news. I think that's fair
totally,
to say.
Totally, yeah. Jay, also, would you like to say hello, Saul?
Hello, Saul.
Oh.
Hello, Jay and Dave.
And stay right close here to the mic.
Yeah.
Okay. And a listener to this program, right, Saul?
Totally, yeah.
I am. In my living room.
It blows me away that we actually have listeners to this thing.
What do you mean?
People like Saul Hansel listen to our show. I mean, that was amazing, you know.
It is a compliment.
Now, it turns out that when Saul is listening to our show, Jay,
He's doing laundry. Which actually was the origins of this show.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Now that it's all coming back to me.
Right. For a few weeks, we called it Laundry Notes Podcast because Dave used to call me on Sunday
when he was doing his laundry. And
that
didn't work out, so we moved
it
to Mondays. So it sent the wrong message.
But the April Fresh smell is still woven
into
the whole thing.
It wasn't the April Fresh smell that attracted us to you, Saul.
We're sort of the fabric softeners of the news industry. Yeah.
That's an interesting way of putting it. But I heard you were yelling at the clothes.
Wow. Tell us
at
about
the poor
this.
Clothes. Actually, would you yell at us, please? And I understood that it was mainly me that you were yelling at.
I am so honored to be here. I want to start out.
Oh, cut it out. Come on. Let's hear the yelling.
No, continue.
All right, so, shall I just
go
yell?
Right into it, man. Let's
what
go.
An engineer-centric thing to say, I might have said to the towel.
Well,
it's not that simple, and not everybody wants to do it all those ways.
Okay, now, would you
that
give
would
us
be
a little context?
Thing I would say.
Okay, well, back up a second. What is it that I said that's
bonkers?
Well,
I have no idea. I don't remember.
Okay.
But
well, in my own defense, I actually am an engineer by training. But I don't know. How can I defend myself? I don't know what I said.
We can get going.
Come on, let's have an argument.
Okay.
I'm really disappointed.
You want to have an argument?
Yeah.
I think Saul's point was that we sometimes oversimplify things
what journalists
show,
do, yeah.
And we neglect, in our enthusiasm for the emerging new system of news, to note and observe that the old ways work just fine in many ways, and furthermore, that if the focus is on serving users, that in many ways those users will be best served by things that are rather traditional. I think that's the point that he was making.
I'm not sure about traditional, but you have to take it apart and understand why was something done the way it was done before. So if it was done the way it was done before because of the limited distribution, right? Only a travel agent could book a ticket because they could only afford the computer. Only a certified reporter could be in the press conference and nobody else could hear the press secretary speak. In this world of technology, that all goes away, right? So anything that the reason behind it was access and distribution, we shuffle that all apart. And you guys are all about that. But
that's part of what we're all about.
Right.
Yeah. And then the implications, what follows from that, because those things have changed, right?
But if it turns out that some of the things that people were doing before still have some value, narrative, experience, perhaps in combination with new stuff, it's easy, I guess. My philosophy of looking at technology is to believe that almost always the answer is all of the above. Look at blogging, right? At this point in the world, blogging isn't a very interesting thing to talk about anymore, right? Blogs came out, it was a little bit from the left field, and there was an aspect, you know, it had two or three separate aspects. There was anybody can do it, the format was easy and useful for everybody, there was a culture of linking, and there was a culture of comments. There were some other things, but those were many of the central aspects. Those can get taken apart and put back together, and any organization, be it the United Nations, the New York Times, or my daughter who just started a blog on her middle school thing, can use aspects of that. And so when people talked about bloggers and the blogging revolution, they were mixing up too many concepts. They were thinking, oh, the access to the media for the people who didn't have access before is what blogging's about. No, access is about access, and blogs are separate from that, and people get confused. I don't think you got confused.
No, but I'm not... well, forget about who gets confused about what, but I think actually you're confused.
No doubt.
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, on a number of issues. Number one, first of all, I place a high value on the work that professional journalists do. I have a window open on my computer, my main work computer, that is hooked into my very latest thing, which is called FeedHose, which gives you a real-time feed of news. And guess what comes in to that window every time there's an update? It's a story from the New York Times. So it's not a random story from some blogger. It happens to be that is the feed that I have coming into my desktop. So to say that I place a value on what those people do, let me be clear. I place a value on what those people do.
Well, that's Jay putting but words in
wait,
my mouth.
No. But I just want to be very clear about that, because a lot of times, I'm thinking of, any number of different people, even people who've been on this show, hold me accountable for wanting to see the demise of that activity and anything. I do a lot of things to try to help preserve that. I like to work with those organizations to help them use the latest technology. Now, they very often feel very threatened by me and don't want to talk to me, because I think they misunderstand my motives. They probably think that I'm there to try to undermine them and destroy them, when in fact my motives are really WYSIWYG. It's what you see is what you get. It's like I'm here trying to get you using the same very latest technology that we independent sources type people are using, so that we can all be competing on a level playing field. And there is competition, Saul, and it's not of the nature, and a lot of times people misunderstand this, especially people who've been reporters misunderstand this. I think it's a misunderstanding to think that what an individual writing publicly is doing is the same thing that what a reporter is doing, because it's not. We don't see it that way, okay? I mean, I don't see myself as doing what a reporter does. I see myself more as the source, the type of person the reporter talks to. And I have found, now, you know, a lot of times when people think about news, especially people in the profession, they only think about it from their own perspective, their own point of view, right? And you hear words like audience, which I think completely doesn't work anymore. Because it's more like there's a community, and there's all people play all kinds of roles. And there are people who are, you know, in that are wanting the information, there are people who are providing the information, and there are people who synthesize that into some other kind of information, right? And there may be other roles, but those seem to me to be the main ones, right? And we have interests, too, those of us who have been sources. And our interest, the way I would put it, is we want to get our point of view out there accurately. And it's always been a problem. It's like the travel agent who always used to send me to golf resorts. I don't play golf. Why did she send me to golf resorts? Probably because she thought everybody was like her and liked golf resorts. Even if I don't play golf, why wouldn't I want to stay in the most beautiful spot, you know, with the best sunshine and all this great... No, I like being in the city, actually. I prefer to be in the city. Well, if I have something to say, going through a reporter may not be the most efficient way for me to actually say it. In fact, it never is. And we've had countless discussions here on the show where we're talking about things that just never get reported. They just never make it out there. I've observed, like, for example, any new idea about media will not appear in the pages of the New York Times until a New York Times reporter or editor has that epiphany. Until they have it, it won't appear. There's no way for it to get there.
Isn't that the definition of the New York Times? Well, the definition of the New York Times is
no, you
the
see,
things
not
about
me.
Which the writers and editors of the New York Times had epiphanies of.
Yes, I know, but yes. I have a vision that it could be much bigger than that and much better than that, okay? That because the New York Times isn't that to me. The New York Times is partially that, but it is also the community of people that are gathered around it. that are sources for it and who get their information from it. I'm not particularly served by only having the insights of people who work for the New York Times, in the New York Times. And frankly, I think if you stop and think about it, Saul, if you really stop and think about it, that is not the mission of the New York Times.
I didn't say that's the mission. I think that's what the product currently is.
I don't think that's what the product is, ever has been, or is today.
First of all, I agree with everything you've said.
I think that's part of what it is today, but I don't. I really entertaining the hell out of Jay over there. He's sort of kicking back at letting us out.
I need to, by the way, just describe for people, because my laundry room vision of what this podcast was like is not what it looks like.
Really?
Because
you've what's
got,
it like?
You know, I'm sitting here in a slightly big little radio studio, you know, around the corner from Dave, but Jay is on the other side of the soundproof glass wall.
He could be in California.
Like, he is in the, he's the controller of all of us.
Totally.
He's the director and,
or
is sitting there turning the mic down and just blogging away and ignoring us.
But no, he's not, definitely, I can see him very clearly, he ain't ignoring us.
There is a...
Don't forget Adrian. You got Adrian.
Hello, Adrian.
Hey, that's Adrian, by the way.
Adrian is sitting
Adrian,
in the
would
room
you say
that
hello?
Dave and I are in.
Adrian never says a word.
Wait.
I heard something.
Well, let's go on with our conversation here. Saul, you were going to say to Dave, in reply to what he just said, what?
Well, I basically...
You agree with 90%?
I agree. You know, I'm not defending anything other than thinking about things. One place where
it drives me crazy. You want to know when I scream at the laundry?
When do you scream at the laundry?
When that guy, what's his name, Carr?
David Carr.
Goes on and on and on and on and on and only tells the one story he knows about new media.
Okay.
But there's so many other stories in the jungle.
Guess what?
Well, why can't we get those in there? Here you got this great meeting place where all the great thinkers of our time get together. That's the way I would... That's when I grew up reading the New York Times in New York, Saul. That's what I imagined it was.
Well, here's a thing. One of the things... When I got to AOL, right? AOL has gone through so many twists and turns.
That's not how I imagine AOL, by the way.
Okay, and...
Sorry.
Right now, AOL has many dozens of brand names. The previous management wanted to take AOL's name off of everything. So it's not AOL Sports, it's Fan House, it's not AOL News Politics Department, it's Politics Daily. Each of these has been fragmented. And there were some people who were trying to merge that all together. People who think technology platform want to make it all universal. And one of the things that I think is true about media is that a good media property, whether it's big like the New York Times or medium-sized or small, has a point of view, a perspective, a community, and the New York Times or any media property of any value is only good when there's things that it's not. And so you may well be right. I believe that you are right. In this world, with the permeable borders of things, yes, the New York Times is, to use their internal strategy, convening a community, and there is more than just what the people, the staff of the New York Times has. But the core of what makes the New York Times different from other things, from the AP, from the Huffington Post, from aggregation, from Google News, is that staff. So there's nothing that is going to be a successful New York Times that doesn't have a bunch of smart people somewhere connected on the critical path. I'm not saying with a big wall around them.
Well, of course, that's what the staff came up with. The staff decided that that's what the New York Times is.
Well, it's the distinctive. What
but
is
you see,
there
is a
the
choice. There was a choice.
Yep.
Okay, and I think they've made the wrong choice. Okay. But there was a choice at some point as to whether or not the Times was going to grow along with the Internet. That when the Internet came along, that represented a moment of transition, a moment of change, a moment when things were going to change one way or another. And they decided not to change. They decided not to change as much as possible, and that's their fundamental problem.
Here's what I think Dave is saying. By the way, the way to get somebody talking is to paraphrase what they just said, and then they always object and say, no, that's not what I said, and then they explain what they really meant. So that's what I was doing to you before. But now I'm going to do it to Dave. I think what he's saying is...
That's not what I'm saying.
Dave has said for a long time, and this is a provocative idea, that every time somebody is quoted in the New York Times or shows up on the op-ed page, the Times should give them a blog
totally,
and give them a voice... at nytimes.com.
I wrote that in a memo 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
I
mean,
so I wrote before you did.
I'm sure you did.
Okay. But let me just finish. Let me,
so
the notion is there that the,
so we're
that,
in
the,
agreement.
That the New York Times is its staff and the excellent people who work for it, plus its community or its readers, and by bringing up those voices to put them on a maybe not equal but similar plane to the staff with the internet, that would have been the transformation. But Dave doesn't see that, and that's why you think they...
No, not equal. Not equal.
I said equal or similar.
No, but I would be more specific. Level. In other words, maybe I could, as a source, once I get my platform, maybe I could be bigger than Paul Krugman.
Okay.
Maybe I could grow. But I mean, by the way, I think Paul Krugman is the prototype of exactly what I'm talking about.
He was a source, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't care how he got to be what he is,
yeah.
But he's doing what I think the Times needs to do on a massive scale.
So what would be your... if the New York Times hadn't screwed up the internet the way you say they did...
It's not too late.
I understand. Yeah. But the two or three most important things they would have done differently to play the hand they were given circa 1995...
I had two recommendations in 2002 when I had a meeting with... Martin Niesenholz. One was, give me the XML from the New York Times so I can give that to the world. And he did that, and that's how RSS happened.
Yep.
And the other side was exactly what Jay said. You know, is I found, okay, I would like them to be more open than what I had suggested, but this, I felt, was the compromise, since the Times places such a heavy emphasis on the quality of their editorial people, let's give them the power to determine who has a voice at nytimes.com. But then after that happens, then they have to compete with those people.
So let's imagine...
And then if it's true that they add so much value, right? And I'm telling you that I think there is true that they, some of them in some ways do add a lot of value, because I'm still reading their stuff, right? If it's true that they add the value, then that will be the way it shakes out.
So the a couple of... I don't believe that... There's anything wrong with either.
Let me just say one more thing. One more thing is, that's going to happen anyway.
Of course it is.
What I described, no, it hasn't completely happened yet, but it's on its way. Okay? And it would be a lot further along today had the Times done that in 2002. And it would have been a more orderly process with higher quality. And the New York Times would be making all the money that Twitter is making or going to make. Every dime you see Twitter make, they would have been making, and probably a lot of the dimes Google's making too.
Yeah. I don't agree with
because
any of
they would have grown so huge. Saul,
let me walk you through my take on what you just said, okay?
Sure.
And why I think that, and this is that you have perfectly good ideas that are not on the critical path that you think they are. So imagine earlier on that the Times embraced even more than it did with RSS and remix culture and made all of its stuff as available as it possibly could. So that's step one. Step two, it made its platform open, so in every way we can think of. So there's an article on, you know, the new agriculture policy, and in the best user interface we can imagine, everybody who has a stake in that, who was mentioned or otherwise, has a way of using a platform to have a discussion. So you have, if I'm getting you right, in parallel, the reporter's still doing what the reporter has, but the source is having direct access to the same publishing. So with no more than a click, I can see the Secretary of Agriculture, the corn farmer.
No, more than a click. It would be more than a click.
Well, however, you know, there's a...
Well, no, that would link to the person they're quoting for sure.
Well, let's...
I think they're buying into that anyway.
Okay, so let us just assume, whatever it is you're saying, there is this platform. Right, so you're saying we are leveling the playing field, and you, corn farmer, you, agricultural baron, you, communist, revolutionary, every possible angle has that same, can be on nytimes.com with that page rank. So we have from each according to his value, on behalf of each, according to, you know, the New York Times' page rank, right? So you've figured out the UI problem. I'm just assuming that you've done that. And so there is some kaleidoscope. So I can sit there and I can get the New York Times narrated version, and anytime I want. That's not it?
No.
So
no.
Give me the picture. What would it
look
like?
No, but I mean, see, I think that's the hang up. What you're doing is you're driving it into a contradiction that I don't put in there, okay? I didn't say the Times had to link to anything from anywhere. I just said,
give them a platform.
Give me a platform. Give me a place. Give me a spot at nytimes.com, and I will make of that what I can make of it. If I can get your reporter to point to me, in other words, can I get a second quote? Can I get him to come back?
So what's the user experience?
Let me finish. Yeah, no, there's no change. It's whatever the editors of the Times want the user experience to be on the New York Times product. I'm not saying that they have to give me flow from their stories. That would be ridiculous. And that would be a People's Republic type solution. I'm not a communist, okay?
So I go to the agriculture story. You're quoted in the agriculture story.
Then you should link that, obviously. I think, all agree. I don't think there's any disagreement today that if you quote me, and I said that on the web, you should link to it, right?
Right.
Yes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, that's all. Nothing more.
And then, if that's the case, I'm not sure, right, about the revolutionary aspect, because I believe that revolutions happen in the Internet.
That was just the first step. That was just the first step, Saul. After you have them all convened there and all that stuff flowing through there, the next level of ideas will present themselves. The people will start thinking of different ways of combining themselves into different kinds of editorial products, and those might end up being the places with the bigger flow, and it might turn out that the New York Times reporter is trying to get links from them for his story. It might be the other way around. There are places on the web, as I'm sure you know, that have higher flow than NewYorkTimes.com.
See, I think that's happened. I think you were saying, well, if the New York Times were the Internet, it would be everything.
Right.
I think the Internet, right, if I want to know what Jay Rosen thinks and the Times, God help him, didn't link to Jay Rosen, 90%, certainly 175% of the people you think would be interested in this know how to go Jay Rosen into their Google thing, and they'll find his blog right away and his dialogue. So there was a point a couple years ago, maybe, where the Times could have been the Internet before the Internet got to the Internet.
I don't think we're there, actually. I think what happened here, if you look at what the Internet actually became, we're in deep shit, Saul. We're in real deep trouble, okay? The reason why is we have, instead of going into a corporate platform owned by a news organization, which is what the Times is, we've instead gone into corporate platforms owned by Evan Williams, Mark Zuckerberg, and Larry and Sergey. And I don't know which one of those I prefer, but I don't like the way it turned out. I don't think these tech guys, of which I am one, okay, I don't think they have any special appreciation for news. I think they do, but I don't think that they actually do. And we are, like it or not, more or less controlled by those people.
But that's why I agree with
you. Look where you get your paycheck from, for crying out loud.
Well, I get my paycheck from a news organization.
Let the man talk, Dave.
So
I'm not saying a word.
What do you do in the economy we're in, right? We aren't... You have individuals, mostly for profit, but not in any way entirely for profit, doing things, and they have points of view. And so what do we like better? As much as I love the New York Times, I would rather have the Internet on the Internet and have Facebook and Microsoft and Twitter and the New York Times and Yahoo and AOL competing in different ways. And there are lots of platforms that are incredibly powerful, but they do evolve. And so this back and forth between universality and point of view, the thing that I would argue made Twitter very powerful was the point of view that said 140 characters, totally open how you get in and how you get out. Right? That's a very powerful, provocative statement that had a user insight into that. There was a lot that went into the definition for the first couple of years. And now they've got momentum and they're playing around. Do we have to say totally open or not? They're being, there's a lot going on, but that got them someplace. Zuckerberg was so convinced for the first couple of years, he was about person-to-person communication. And that's what got him where it was. I think about this a lot because I spent 15 years looking at startups coming and showing me, here's my great startup. And they would show me their PowerPoint if I couldn't, not let them show it to me. And they would talk about it. And, it got to be a nice little hobby, like a armchair venture capitalist. Which of these guys is going to succeed? And, when you try and say, what's your advantage? What are you making here that nobody else can make? How does your factory work? And why is your method of production unique? And I see that now when we have at AOL so many opportunities, and I say, how do we, you know, what can we make that nobody else can make? Because we want to make that and we can put it together. I think, and I look at our competition as the New York Times newspaper and About.com, which they own but run separately, and Google News, and Wikipedia is a huge competitor, and Dig and Twitter and all of these things, and each of them has their own methodology. Jay's heard me say this. I like to think that our advantage is we are not bound to one methodology, and we can be the company that does best when we can blend people and machines, professionals and amateurs, you know, aggregation and original.
So let me ask you a question. Yeah. You spent how many years as a technology reporter?
I was a full-time technology reporter for about a dozen years and had technology as a minor covering finance for like 10 years before that.
Okay. So almost 20 years at least reporting on some section of technology. And I think because I've heard you talk about this before, you got attracted to the idea of sort of crossing over and being an executive. Right? With
yep.
AOL. Not, you didn't want to be a content producer. You wanted to actually run something for
that's
AOL.
That's correct.
And that's very different than being a reporter, writer, observer. So you've had how long now?
9 months.
Okay, at this job. And you're now on the inside trying to run a division of a media company.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that been like?
It's been interesting. I don't for a minute regret the choice I made because I wanted to do something else. I wanted to build something. And AOL has such a huge opportunity given our hand to build things. It's complicated. It's complicated for all the reasons why AOL is attractive. 25 years of history, 100 million users every month, lots of different properties at various points in their life cycle, and a bunch of complicated ideas we're trying to take to a bunch of traditional new media people who are basically bloggers and reporters and say, we're going to play with using an extended workforce as part of your mix of sources in your property. It's much more complicated to say and than or. Demand Media that uses this methodology says or. The New York Times said we're going to have two different divisions and they're never going to talk to each other. We're saying what AOL should be is what would have happened if the New York Times and About had merged.
Uh-huh.
That is a very... There's a lot of questions. You know, there's tech questions, there's trust questions. All the stuff you guys talk about come up every single day.
So, okay. So when you say that we're trying to get people to understand some really complicated ideas... Give me an example is one of those.
Well, here's an interesting, you know...
Because we do complication here, right, Dave?
I'll tell you, you know, if you... This is live as we speak, right? So one of the most interesting dialogues I've had over the last 9 months is with Melinda Henenberg, who also comes from the Times, although I didn't really know her there, and she is the editor
you
of...
Do you know her, Jay, or you're laughing?
I'm laughing because her site is one of my least favorite sites on the Internet.
And why is that, Jay?
Because it is completely conventional, traditional, old-school journalists taking their show to the Internet and trying to be as uninnovative as possible.
Okay.
That's
although
my view.
All right.
Okay, now maybe it'll evolve, maybe it'll change, maybe it's in motion, but when I look at Politics Daily, I see people taking what they had always done as political reporters, pundits, and just putting it on the Internet with
and would you how would you compare that to Politico?
Well, I think Politico is different. It is trying to imitate Politico, but Politico was already there when they started. Politico changed the metabolism of political journalism. Politics Daily has done nothing at all but imitate others and carry what had been onto the Internet.
I think that Melinda would say, I don't want to speak for her, but she would talk about representing a set of subject matters and interests and points of view that are different from those represented in Politico, even if I think she would agree with you that the methodologies are more traditional than not. And they will make a very strong argument. When I first talked to her and Carl Cannon, who's the deputy, about using seed. They were very concerned as about political operatives infiltrating seed. They talked about, you know, this or that page on Wikipedia that is infested by Moonies or whatever. They were articulating, I think, some of the reasons why the gatekeepers keep gates. And
okay. So what's the complicated idea you're trying to get them to accept?
You know, after going back and forth, we have a new idea that we're playing around with, which is up now, which is supplementing, not competing with their coverage. We're looking at search data, and we're saying, what are people asking about the
elections? I've seen that. Yeah.
And so this is very much your reporter on call, but using, you know, the hive mind of Google, which is fascinating, and all of search, as our question box. And it turns out that a lot of people are asking, how old is Barbara Boxer? And is Carly Fiorina married? Mm-hmm. And a bunch of questions that you could find if you wanted to do work. But lots of people don't want to do work. They want things handed to them in an easy fashion. And my belief in this world is, I don't want to be bigger than my audience. I want to meet them wherever they are. And if they took the time to type into Google, how old is Barbara Boxer? I don't want to say, you should have typed Barbara Boxer biography, gotten to that, and figured it out from the birthday. I want to give them a post that says Barbara Boxer's 58.
And is that really how old she is?
I have no idea. You know, but it's on there. If you, anybody listening,
just
type
curious,
how old is Barbara Boxer in Politics Daily.
I'll get
comes
you the
up.
Answer.
So now Politics Daily is producing posts that correspond to these search inquiries, correct?
That they are. And we...
How are they doing?
Okay. I mean, they are doing great in terms of Google ranking, so we are serving the audience. And we, because we're giving people exactly what they want, people can find them. We're not going to get rich on this, but they're part of a balanced diet of interesting information that make you think that Politics Daily is smarter and more comprehensive. They let us experiment with formats. And we're sitting here literally day by day trying to figure out how much fact-checking, how much editing, who should edit these things, because the state, you know, the election's in 3 weeks. We had one where somebody's political point of view was misrepresented based on, I think, an honest misreading of some piece of it, and the campaign called us up and said, you know, change this from this to that. And how much do we want to spend? Because if you're going to sit there and answer questions that only 100 people a day are asking, or 1,000 people a day,
right,
they're giving you a budget. You have to work within, you know, you have to only spend as much money as you can make serving that nice little small group.
You mean the subgroup of people who are interested in that question are giving you a budget,
yeah,
an implied budget.
Right. If you have a $10 CPM and you have 1,000 people, right, there's $10 of ad revenue, assuming you get 100% of those impressions.
Okay. So let me see if I understand what you're saying. AOL owns all this search data. You go to politicsdaily.com and say, look, what about this? We can find out which questions people are often searching for information about political figures on or political subjects. It makes sense to produce posts into that demand. The way to do it is not to use your high-priced on-staff talent, but to use the network of contributors that Seed.com represents. And why don't we start to answer some of those search queries with PoliticsDaily.com content, because that will... result in useful information, raise the search profile of the site, and be part of the mix of what an effective 21st century political site should be, right?
Yeah. And we're moving, you know, so we started with easy ones. We see who does a good job with those. We're moving on to issue ones. What does Barbara Boxer think of abortion? What does Governor so-and-so think of gun control?
All right.
And then we're going to, you know, look at other stuff. You know, there's a lot of trade-offs that have to do with managing this. And if Dave were, you know, somebody might say, can this be more self-organizing than top-down? And that's a really interesting question. The fact-checking, the branding, if you our strength and our weakness is the hybrid nature. So if you have a site that reads to all concerned like an old-school journalism site.
It does.
It does, okay? Yeah. And that is clearly a value to somebody. Somebody read a newspaper yesterday. Somebody went to the Washington Post, somebody went to Politics Daily and the Politico, so it's not the only thing you could do in the world. It may or may not be the most innovative, but somebody likes it. And moreover, somebody sees a brand and they understand what the experience is, and the brand helps them interpret the information. All of the rest of the experience tells you you know, what you should trust, what kind of biases there are, all that, if you're a decent, educated consumer. And then suddenly we throw something else into the mix, right, that has different attributes. If we do our job right, they balance each other out. The smart people who do the good stuff that is traditional journalism make us smarter. They help edit or spot check or help us make the assignments, and we use that experience and we leverage it and multiply it. If we do our job badly, the two parts of the site are fighting each other and they have two different rhythms, and it makes it harder for people to understand what they're seeing. So I think that I think a lot about brands and brand promises, and when I worked as a blogger at the New York Times, I could call it a blog all I wanted and say I have a different voice, tone, latitude, but that New York Times logotype dwarfs everything. The brand tells people how to interpret it, and we want to make sure our brand stands for something coherent that we can deliver consistently so people understand why they're going to like it and how to interpret
it. That's a big challenge with AOL. Dave, what else is on our list?
Let's see. Talking about corporate hackathons.
Yeah.
You suggested we talk about, Bob Woodward, Dropbox.
Let's do Woodward.
Woodward, okay. Well, it's a big switching gears here because we're having this sort of deep, almost esoteric conversation. When Bob Woodward said something very plain and simple, let me get the actual quote. And I was very heartened by this quote, so I wasn't... Give me a second here to dig it up. He was asked, why are you not on Twitter? And he says, first, I'm not sure what it is. Which is, by the way, a very honest thing to say about it, because I don't know too many people who are sure what it is. He said, part of my problem with the media is the impatience of speed, which drives everything. As you know, I do long form. On Twitter, you can do 140 characters. I think that more or less sums up the issue. There's also the question of, you know, he already works for the Washington Post. I think he has a gig with ABC News. He writes books. In other words, his writing is paid for. And so when he looks at some, this was an angle on it that they didn't mention, but I saw it loud and clear, and it's something I'm feeling more and more every day. Because, you know, when I signed up with Twitter, I was very early. I was like number 3,000 in terms of their users. And when I started up, it was very unsure what it was. It was only used by super insiders in the tech industry. I have it all documented, my blog posts on it. Does it have an API? Then I found out it has an API. It's got a very nice API. It's very open. It allows me to hack it up. I'm on a level playing field, you know, both from the terms of being a software developer and in terms of being a contributor. It has all these wonderful attributes that give me this illusion that I could set up shop here and truly do something wonderful. But all the while, there's this nagging doubt in the back of my head saying that they could change the rules on me anytime. This goes back to what we were talking about 2 weeks ago. Anytime they could change the rules.
Right.
Their end user agreement even says it. Their lawyers made them tell the truth,
right,
which is at any moment we could change our mind and screw you and you would have no recourse. It almost literally says that in every one of these agreements, the ones we never bother reading. And so here we are, fast forward now, it's like 4 years later. It's more than 4 years later. And all the things that were nagging doubts in the back of my head have come true. You know, I've had to deal with a situation where areas where I beat the big companies from a technological standpoint by a matter of years, okay? Well, their content is displayed, and mine isn't even displayed. Can't even get equity with those, with AOL, with Yahoo, with Google, and a few other developers. I don't count. My pictures can't be displayed in the beautiful new box they put there.
Mm-hmm.
If I want, as a user, as a content guy, if I want my stuff there, I have to go with some tech company. However, what's the point? Because I wasn't on the suggested user list, and so I only have 30,000 followers, And I don't even, come on, it's like ridiculous on ridiculous at 18,000 different levels. I mean, that was ancient history that suggested user list. Now, God knows how many followers.
So how does this make you sympathize with what
Well, because he didn't sell out. Because he's not the chump. Because I likened it in this piece that I wrote. It's like, here I am, addict. I feel really addicted. Because on the one hand, on a personal level, I am addicted. Mm-hmm. I just always want to tweet stuff. Like, I've already taken a picture of you, Saul, and I've already tweeted it. Okay? It's on Flickr.
So you're
and
feeling like a sucker.
Well, that's the addiction part of it. Yeah. Okay? The other side of it is a pragmatic addiction. Okay? In the sense that because I let everybody that I care about into this thing, or they would have found their way anyway. Who knows what happened, right? Now I'm dependent on it because if I want to communicate with those people, that's the way
communicate. That's where they are, yeah.
Right. So, you know, I'm like the addict looking at the guy who says, nah, I don't want to take the first cigarette. Or I don't want the first hit of heroin or cocaine.
Right.
I'm just going to stay
right.
here.
So you're
and
saying
do
that's a good idea, yeah.
Because I don't, because God help, you know, when I was a teenager, I started smoking. This is the real Dave here, by the way, talking. I didn't understand how addictive it would be, you know, and how impossible, what a fiend I would become with it. And, you know, I felt invincible, et cetera, right? Well, here I'm looking at Woodward saying the same kind of thing. If I could go back to the 17-year-old Dave and say, look, Dave, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for you to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really not a good decision, right? That's what, you know, 55-year-old Dave would go back to that guy. Well,
I'm
here's
sure your 17-year-old self would listen to
would
us.
Say, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, but on the other hand, here's Bob Woodward, who is equivalent to the 17-year-old.
I'm glad Woodward's not on Twitter.
Well, some other person said that, too, but I didn't think they were being kind to Woodward when they said it. It's like, but actually, I wanted to counterbalance that because I felt like giving the guy a hug. Because you know what? I just want to get this one point out there. We're going to have that friend feed experience there, you and me, Jay. I promise you there will come a moment. We'll be sitting in this very room, knock wood, should we survive.
Yeah.
Right? Murphy, Willing, and all the rest of it. We will have this conversation where I will say, I told you so,
yeah.
And you'll go, you're right, you did.
I mean, if you think about people who have careers, say as journalists or writers or frankly anything else, you know, they aren't all the same. Some people like to write articles and books, some only books. Some give commencement speeches, some don't. Some go on talk shows, some don't. It feels totally ordinary in the course of just the bell curve of humanity that somebody who seems to be pretty good at weaseling his way into the White House to listen to people argue about which war to be in, which is a particular skill, that would have choices that wouldn't be the same as other people's about
sure.
every other aspect of their career. That I don't even see why it is of note that he doesn't.
Because I'm using this as an allegory for a bigger story, which is
we
need to get our independence from this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the frog. The title of the piece was like, I'm a frog boiling in water here. You know, sooner or later, it's just going to have to bite the bullet. I'm going to have to quit this thing. And I'm going to have to do it in a way that does not get me into this mess again. And it's going to be the same thing that we did in 1992, 93, 94, when we said goodbye to the personal computer industry as being our governors and said, let's create this thing called the web where we won't have any rules and we can do whatever the hell we please. That's what I'm saying, Saul. Your interpretation is perfectly valid. I'm not saying it's not. And I'm sure that's the way Woodward meant it, and I'm sure that's the way Kurtz heard it, okay? But I'm saying that there's another angle.
Well, the battle between proprietary platforms and open, right, plays out generation by generation. Somebody invents something.
Yeah.
It's too good for them to keep control over, and the forces play out over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And it plays out in 140 characters as it does with
it's
everything
else. It's a persistent theme of this show.
Right. As you get older enough,
I hope all three of us would agree that if Woodward...
We have 60 seconds,
if Woodward was going to do a New Yorker piece about Twitter, then he ought to, in fact, start using it.
Yeah.
But that is not the approach Malcolm Gladwell took in his New Yorker article, and I just continue to find that incredible. I don't think there's anything else that the New Yorker would allow that level of deliberate ignorance about the subject matter in a long profile about that subject. I can't think of another situation where that would happen. It's like saying, I'm going to review this movie, but I'm not going to go see the movie.
On that note, we have to thank our guests.
So, thanks for coming on.
It's great to be here.
And thanks for listening.
To do this again. So sorry for all the arguing, but I thought it made good.
That's what you guys do.
That's what we do, yeah.
We argue a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody.
Bye.